And now, dear listeners, here is part two of our talk with our friends over at Type 1 Radio Lounge. Enjoy.
Let's talk about that. I do address this in the book. You know, this book is a chronicle of my experiences. And one of the experiences I had, I realized I was being used by Brother Masons to form a new research body in the area that I lived in. You know, I was the only one qualified to sign the application to be able to start a new, it's called a Council of the AMD, and it was basically a Allied Masonic degrees. It was sort of a side order that I've spoken of before, that you have to be a Freemason to join it, but it's not really Freemasonry. It's a separate order, and it was contained 15 continental degrees from Europe that were sort of side degrees that floated around in the 18th century and then just kind of, you know, never found a home. So they were all brought under the one umbrella called the Allied Masonic Degrees, and they formed these – a bunch of guys back in the 30s, American Freemasons, went over to England and the continent of in France and Germany and got these degrees and brought them back and started this side order. And these guys – these are key Masons too in the whole southern jurisdiction of the Scottish Rite, the Supreme Council. Well, I joined it before I knew any of the stuff I just told you guys about because locally out in the Midwest I was invited and it was prestigious and blah, 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 blah. So I just happened – and they make you a Knight of Constantinople. You're knighted and you're made a Knight of Constantinople. And so I hold this degree. I have these papers, blah, blah, blah. So I moved to Massachusetts where I don't go to the meetings because it's in the Midwest. It's in Kansas, you know. So I'm in Massachusetts, and I'm at this point pretty much completely frustrated with the snobby, high-class masonry out there because it's Massachusetts, so it's old money establishment. And it's a lot of people are very class-oriented. You know what I'm talking about, guys. Aristocracy. Yeah. They all think that they're better than you. And they don't want to even sit and lodge with you because you're just a commoner. Everybody wears the white gloves in Massachusetts lodges all the time in the meetings because that's the equalizer. See, if we're all wearing white gloves, you can't see my hands and see that I'm just a commoner with beat up fingernails and stuff. You know what I mean? And so that's the real reason for the white gloves too, by the way, guys. So while I'm not even going to these lodges, I've made a few friends and people know who I am and they're calling me sometimes. And I 6 months goes by, I'm starting to do the radio show. This is right when I started doing the radio show. And they contact me and they're like, we want a couple of guys, key guys who really could be persuasive because I was friends with them. And they said, they knew I wanted to start a lodge of research. There wasn't one to serve the need of people who really wanted to learn about this stuff. And so I was frustrated and I was blocked from doing that. I was told in no uncertain terms, if you continue, there's a lot of guys in this room who think they're the smartest guy in the room, and you're coming in and up and setting the apple cart. And if you continue, they will – these were the exact words – they will target you and destroy you if you continue.
Wow.
That's what they told – and there was a guy who told me this was during there was a dinner in the other room. We were sitting inside of an empty lodge room, and there was nobody around but me and him, and he looked me right in the eye and told me, you better be careful because you're about to get destroyed. And I'm like – well, I laughed nervously, like, what are you talking about? We're just philosophizing about Freemasonry. What do you mean by that? He's like, I'm just saying. I've seen it happen before, and you won't like the results. So I walked out of that place scared pretty much out of my wits about it and said, I'm never going back. 6 months go by, I don't go to any meetings, and all of a sudden I get a couple calls, and these guys are like, hey, you know, we heard you wanted to start a lodge of research, and you know, so we'd like you to be the one to help us do it because you already are a member of the AMD and that's a research body, and we could do it if you sign the application because you're qualified. You're a Knight of Constantinople.
Uh-huh.
And none of us are. We can't even sign the application. So I got suckered into it. I signed the application. I sent it off to Washington to be approved. And then I found out that one of the key Scottish Rite guys who had blocked me and had been really against what I was trying to do in the jurisdiction was being made the head position of this order. He was being made the sovereign master. And they told me, oh, we have to have him involved because he's such an influential Mason. And he'll lend credibility to this whole thing with all the other, quote unquote, successful and influential Masons that we want to attract to the order. And I
right,
said, you
right.
guys,
and he'll be able to keep a close eye on you is what's going on there.
Yeah, well, also because it was really his idea. What they wanted to do, I found out after the fact, because as soon as the application got approved, they had a secret meeting. They offered me the secretary's chair. So I thought, well, I'll be able to hold the charter. I'll have some power, some sway to make things stay on track. Well, as soon as they got the okay that this order was going to be formed, they had a secret meeting without me even being there. And I'm the secretary. I have to take minutes. I'm supposed to be there, you know. And
right.
at the secret meeting they had, they talked about how they were going to X me right out of it, how they were going to take the charter. charter. Once they got the charter, they were going to lock it in the safe at the lodge. They weren't going to let me have it, and they were going to basically try to marginalize me out of the whole thing. And so I got that information from one of the other members who felt bad when he realized what they were doing, and he contacted me personally and told me all this. So I called Washington. I actually emailed Washington to the Secretary General of the Grand Council of the AMD, and said, I basically told him the whole story. And I gave, and the guy that told me, he sent me an affidavit, which I attached to my email and sent it to the Washington Grand Council, and they completely ignored me. The reason why they ignored me, I realized after, is they wanted another subordinate council to charge money for. See, once you set up a council, every council in America has to pay back to the Grand Council a per diem annual disbursement. You have to like pay the Grand Council to continue to
for the right to say you are this.
That's right. And so I was trying to my suggestion to the Secretary General was
like being a franchise or something.
Yes, exactly. You're a franchise. They send you a charter. It's just like a franchise. And my suggestion was, let's cancel the charter. Let's cancel this all, because it's all under the wrong auspices. They're trying to create a supper club where they can all sit around in tuxedos and pat each other on the back and pretend like they're big shots, where they can wave the membership of this council under the noses like a carrot of new Masons that come in the door to kid them all their buddies all in one little elite supper club away from the rest of the lodge, so they can be, you know, this. And I was sick to death by it. And I contacted the general and I said, let's do this. Let's just cancel everything, because I want my name off that charter. I'm not signing it. I'm not part of this. And he ignored me. I mean, ignored me. I emailed him a couple times. I said, can you please tell me if you're even getting this? And the thing is, guys, I already had a rapport with this guy, because when I became a member of the council in the Midwest, I sent to him for information, for research material. I called him on the phone about shipping, about addresses. So I had already talked to him. He knew me. And he ignored me. So then finally I called his home. I got his phone personal number at home. I called him and he finally picked up, and I found out he had called the other guy, the Sovereign Master Scottish Rite guy, and talked to him about me. He hadn't even called me back. He's like, look, you know, well, come on, man. We, you know, I talked to the other guy and he said, you're overreacting about this. What's your problem?
What?
And he starts trying to back, you know, trying to like soft shoe me, soft pedal me. Right.
I said,
I'm like, listen, I don't know what's going on here, right? But I really want you to cancel my, you know, cancel the whole thing. I don't endorse this at all. And he's like, well, listen, I get it. You don't like this guy. That's fine. Don't you realize you're the secretary? You have absolute power.
Yeah.
You can do anything you want. And he's like, now don't quote me on this. I'll never admit later, right? But if you want to, you could just target him and destroy him. If you don't want him to be a member, why don't you just not send him a dues notice?
They sure throw that word destroy around a lot.
Oh yeah. He's like, you could just don't send him a dues notice. If he doesn't pay dues, you suspend him as a non-paying member. He'll get the message. He'll get the point. And I was like, just horrified. I'm like, this is the top.
All this chicanery and backdoor crap.
Yeah. And I said, okay, thanks a lot for your help. Hung up the phone and never looked back.
Yeah.
You know, and I demitted from that order.
It sounds like they set you up from the get-go.
Absolutely.
They knew you were a powerful player that could create what they wanted. And once you created it, you were waste and you needed to be out of the system.
They had to marginalize me. They had to either see. They knew they couldn't win me over. They'd given me all these accolades and laurels, and they put me in these. I mean, they invited me to join orders that people spend 30 years in Masonry waiting to join. I was invited in my second year. So they tried to dangle these carrots, and then when they realized he's not gonna buy it, he's not taking the bait, he's not drinking the Kool-Aid, he's still kind of speaking rebelliously and still kind of challenging things and not falling into line. They have to marginalize and deactivate you. They got to find a way to keep you stymied and, you know, gelded.
Right.
Jesus kicking over the money.
I use that exact analogy. Exactly. Going into the temple, kicking over the tables, you know. And remember,
well done, my brother.
Yeah, Jesus was left alone for 3 years to preach along the countryside and convert at will. But the minute he kicked over those tables, 2 weeks later, you know, they took him out. That's how it goes. Yeah.
They destroyed him.
Yes, they targeted and destroyed
him.
Yeah.
Well, but
so
they used that word with some regularity. That must mean something.
Oh, well, it meant you should take notice of what we're saying to you, because it's literal, you know. And
right,
and
right.
That, and that's, so that's the blowback on the – that was even before I started all this. I mean, the amazing thing about this book is a lot of the key players are dying off. The very, very key – one of the key players who is the focus of the first chapter of my book – he died this year. You know, he died out here this year, so he's gone. And I mean, he was, you know, 90 something year old Scottish Rite 33rd degree. He was also Knight Templar and a member of all the other orders that you could be. And he was completely, he'd been controlling the lodge I joined for 30 years, iron fisted control. You know,
is that
he'd
the fella you sent me the photograph of, Fredo?
Maybe.
Do you remember sending you sent me the guy who you met through Freeman? Do you remember him? The young guy with the hat?
Oh, no. That's not him.
But there was about four or five other guys.
Oh, yes. There. Yeah, he might have been in that picture. Yeah. Sure, yeah.
The guy in the walking frame, the Zimmer frame.
Yeah, that's how it all started. Yeah, I met the guy. I met Freeman through a Freemason.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, cool.
Wow.
Well,
Thank you for sharing that with us, Frater.
Yeah, yeah, nice one.
You know, because, you know, okay, here's just from this Swami's point of view, sitting in the ashram on the river in the 100-acre woods in the cornfields of Illinois, there are those of us who have a little bit of name. Thomas knows how this feels. And you do good work, and you touch people's lives, and then the shit starts coming. You know? And I just wanted to see if you were willing to talk about some of the stuff you've had to scrape from your shoes. Because, you know, now you are Frater X. I mean, anyone involved in the truther movement or whatever we call this thing we do has access to your information, you know? And you are a personality within the movement specializing in the Freemason angle, which so many people do nothing but demonize. And I'm really thankful you shared that story because this lets people know that, you know, you've been around the movers and shakers in this. You see how they operate. People who have listened to you and who have listened to James Wright and his story, they know that there is a clique of these folks, but they are not the majority of the membership.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Nope.
Because there's the porch masons, they're just looking at it as a social thing. And they never go beyond that, do they?
Yeah, that's a good point. There's all kinds of, you know, it's just like in life. It's the lodge system is a microscopic, just like in life, a macrocosmic, microcosmic. And in life, it's the one or 2% that are the elite, you know, that are living a different life than you and I. And then there's everybody else, you know. I mean, like Jesse Jackson said, you know, we may have come over in different boats, but we're all in the same boat now. You know, so, that's all of us. And then there's the few who, I mean, I always said for years, my saying was, there's only two kinds of people in the world. Those who have to work when they get up in the morning, you have to work. You have to find a way. And those who don't. When they get up in the morning, they don't have to work. It's just all there. It's all there for them.
Right. Well, I wanted to make the point because there are those who are not as fully informed of the issues within the truth community who would go, Frater X, Freemason, oh, he must eat babies.
Yeah, that happens. That happens. It definitely has happened.
I know. Well, we know a guy.
I've never seen him eat a
another
baby.
Another name in the movement who made that comment about you, you know?
Yeah. So, yeah, well, what were you going to say, Mater X? You were saying something there.
That doesn't surprise me at all.
I just said that I've never seen Frater X eat a baby.
Have you ever seen him eat a pizza?
Yes. I've eaten pizza with him. I like pizza.
Is his favorite color Cleo?
Yes, it is. Hey, but that's another story.
If they don't attack,
you're never gonna let that mojo stuff go, are you?
Yeah.
But no, one thing I was gonna say, on a serious note, though, I was gonna say, Swami, that the irony is that nowadays, where I'm like at the point, you know, my conclusion to this book is, well, you know, I gave it a shot, but the whole Freemason thing kind of fizzled as far as I'm concerned. And so, you know, I got people still contacting me to this day who are on the fence wanting to join the lodge. People who all, especially from the UK, I get several, emails a month from the UK from people who are drawn to the lodge, drawn to Freemasonry, who are, you know, they think about it all the time, and they're like, what should I do? They're asking me what they should do. And one thing that I kind of feel bad, because I don't want to discourage their intuition or their inspiration to do what they think they should do, but I also need to be honest with them, and I need to tell them what I think. And I've done a lot of research, and, you know, the point of the matter is that we know now. We know now that our own government was involved with the media in saturating our awareness with Masonic iconography, Masonic symbolism, Egyptian. That's why we can sit around and point to all these things in movies and TV and music that are all these supposedly quasi-Masonic symbols. It's because they're deliberate. They're there for a reason. In 1973, you know, SRI International report to the government, it was called Changing Images of Man. It was edited by two research scientists that were involved in this think tank. The SRI was a social policy think tank. So their job was to sculpt social policy. These are social engineers. And in 1973, they made it clear that they believed that America was headed for a new value system, a spiritual and ecological awakening, awareness of self-realization movements that was coming, and it was virtually unstoppable. This was 1973, that it would bring about a huge transformation in American and in European society, but most especially they focused on America, that it would radically undermine the modern industrial state, culture, institutions, the whole idea of the myth of progress that we've been brought up under, and that it would cause serious social disruptions, economic decline, runaway inflation, institutional upheaval in general, collapse. This is what they said. And they said, we anticipate that there'll be a lessening trust in the authorities, a reaction against regimented, tightly controlled society. So they suggested ways of preventing the worst case scenario by identifying existing institutions or traditions that could be used to control and contain the epic of the new movement. And it was,
traditional. There you go, then. There you go.
Yeah. Freemasonry. So they were using Freemasonry and Egyptian iconography. They suggested that this would be great because it's of special interest to the Western world, because the traditions played such a significant role in the birth of the United States of America, the founding fathers that were connected to it, and that it had a potentiality of reactivating the social American symbolism of it, so that, you know, the reinterpretation of the work ethic and the supporting of the concept of free enterprise and democratic society. This was all wrapped up in it, and they knew it. So then that's 1973. I was 3 years old when that happened.
So what happened?
And now look at our lives.
What you were saying there about reigniting it, that's the basis of all republicanism in Europe is Freemasonic. So that ties in perfectly with that. It's very interesting.
Right. And then if you connect that with the work of guys like Anthony Sutton, right, who we all know about, you know, in his works, he talked about classical liberalism and classical liberalism in the state level. Right. It's always subordinate to the individual. In the Hegelian state, though, the statism, the individual exists only to serve the state. And that's the shift. So that's why my main theory in the secret war inside Freemasonry, when you're talking about it from the theoretical side of things, is that they usurped the system, because Freemasonry was like a Protestant self-help program at one point, post-Renaissance, post-Enlightenment. It was that. It was but it was only available to, you know, it was only available to the upper class, because that was their classist view of reality. They thought, oh, lower classes are just there to dig ditches. They don't care. You know what I mean? It doesn't matter. But so that's not right. But the point was, is that for the upperclassmen, it was a way for him to improve himself. Now, that was extremely dangerous, because at the end of the revolution in America, they opened the doors to all walks of life. Anybody could come in and join a lodge now. So now, we got to do something. We can't let all the working class come in and get all self-actualized and start becoming aware and applying critical thinking from a real classical liberalism type, you know, education. We got to do something. So they usurped it, and they changed it, just like they did with education.
That's why African Americans, to their credit, were very shrewd when they joined the Freemasonry thing very, very early on in big numbers, because it was the only thing that gave them leverage in America at that time.
Yeah, the Prince All Masons, I credit them as being more Masonic than real, than not the real, but the regular lodges. The regular lodges are less Masonic because Prince All Masonry is way more scrutinizing. I've heard that you get denied three times before they'll even let you join, and then you have to write papers. You pay 10 times as much as a white lodge. You pay 10 times as much to join the Prince Hall lodges, and you have to go through a lot more background checks and scrutiny. And there's just a lot more. You're expected to memorize all the material. There's a lot more expectations there.
It sounds more like Jesuits or something.
Well, yeah. I mean, it all has that feel to it, anyways. I mean, it's very similar.
Swami, what you were saying about being attacked.
Yeah.
All the people who attack me and all the groups who attack me have one thing in common. None of them are sexy. When someone sexy comes after me, then I'll be worried.
Yeah, right. Then you're onto something. They're throwing something at you to try to divert your attention.
Right.
So I'm afraid of getting back to the thread of what you were saying. I remember you saying a while back that when you joined the lodge, the Mason sort of thing, it was to advance your knowledge. Would you say that it's as easy to advance your knowledge without being a Mason, i.e. the information that's on the internet these days?
I would say it would be more effective to not join the lodge to learn, because the lodge itself is another thought-stopping process, just like public education, as far as I'm concerned.
Okay, so it's just like
it's changed. It's counterfeited. It's no longer. It's been usurped from within. That's why, like I said, I mean, the program in the Midwest right now, they've adopted their Masonic education program statewide in Kansas, is they've adopted the Complete Idiot's Guide to Freemasonry by S. Brent Morris.
I have a friend, my book dealer, actually, he's like an old Welsh guy, lifelong Freemason, though he's out now. And I didn't notice till he spoke to me about this recently. And I asked him about the Masonic thing. And this is a guy, like, an old Protestant guy going back years. And I asked him, well, what is Freemasonry about? And he says, what it's about? It's rubbish. He says, it's completely useless in this day and age. And that's exactly what you just said there, Frater.
What they're offering is.
He said it was a geeky guy's club at this point.
Yeah, and
that was one of the things I've had to say to others about Mark's seminar, because what Mark went over in the Streetwise Spirituality seminar, the information he was talking about there, once upon a time, you would have had to been a member of these secret societies to even get exposure to this information.
Yep.
Yeah, well,
but
that's
not that way anymore.
That's a good point to make, is that as a species, humanity, knowledge, we ebb and flow with it, and there are times like when so-called, quote-unquote, dark ages pockets happen where, there's a book out there by Thomas Cahill that said how the Irish saved civilization, and in this book they talk about how the monks' scriptoriums and stuff in Ireland, at one point in time, that was the only place for all the knowledge of philosophy and science. Everything up to that point was contained within those places. Everywhere else was the Dark Ages. I mean, there was nothing going on in Europe, in the European area.
There was Islam.
Yeah,
Islam had invaded most of Southern Europe.
Yeah, the Southern Europe.
The idea was to scarper the books into the Western Isles.
Yeah, and so the point is, though, is that that's the ebb. There's the times when it ebbs, and secret societies and orders will rise up, and they serve a function as custodians of knowledge when it doesn't matter to anybody else. But now, I mean, at this point, we are in a time when everybody is accessible, and it should be. And the fact of the matter is that the biggest thing about Freemasonry, which always was an issue that I overlooked in order to gain access, and Mater X pointed it out, I did gain access to materials like libraries and research bodies that I couldn't have gained access to outside, but I would propose to you that the knowledge is found outside too. It's not exclusively there, it was at one time. But the one thing that's always bothered me is the fact that they exclude women. There's no reason for it. It's a ridiculous, patriarchal, patriarchal, antiquated position to take. And yet, you know, that's the main, you know, with Freemasonry, if it's a regular Freemasonry, there can't be any women there. And that's that in and of itself, that one-sided approach to reality breaks it all down. That's why it is useless rubbish, because in the end, you don't need to go to Freemasonry to gain the understanding that you can gain on your own, first of all, you know, doubt and find your own light, but also you don't need to be exclusive in some exclusive little club to gain access and to gain understanding. You know, that's not how it has to be. If you want to play that game, well, that's fine. There's a lot of games that you can play like that, but it's not how it has to be. That's the difference, you know?
That's why he left, actually, because he took an interest in, like, Taoism and martial arts and things like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. And so, you know...
Well, I know, I can tell you from this Swami's perspective, the things I cover and that I'm sharing were once very deeply occulted information. You had to be initiated into the lineages to even hear words about this stuff, you know? But that's why my guru told me, go out and do a radio show and just talk about everything. Hold nothing back. You know, just put it out there, and those who are really interested will come and sit and listen. And if they're, you know, if it's their path to come and grow with us, great. But if they want to go and grow with someone else, great. As long as you grow, we don't care. You know, it's not about stacking up followers. Because let me tell you, as a Swami in this guru biz, having a shitload of followers is a pain in the ass. Because they want me to manage their lives and micromanage it. And I'm like, stop that. I want to make other masters.
Yeah.
I'm not the least bit interested in 30 people bending and bowing to my feet and all this. No, 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 no. I want each individual that I get the opportunity to share information and esoteric energy and processes with to become exactly what I am.
That comes out
Nothing
of Christianity.
Less.
That comes out of Christianity, Swami, the idea of needing a priest or a minister to lead them, and they still haven't broken that programming.
Right.
Well, it's also in our culture. We, you know, the idea of using your own thought, critical thinking, and you know, seeking your own intuition is been blunted. It's been dulled down. You can't have that. You can't be thinking on your own here.
Right.
Working with the collective.
Sit
now.
Down. Shut up. Follow policy. Yeah. Then go home.
And do the mindless. Do the mindless work and then leave.
And
have
leave
you
your money in the kit. In the kitty.
Yeah, leave the money you earn in the little pan.
Swami, here's the book. Here's the book. Just recite everything.
Yeah. Swami, have you seen, this is a little aside, but it reminded me of when you talked about the order you belong to. Have you seen that new Red Ice, Red Shambhala, The Dark Side of Tibetan Buddhism, the two-part series he's got up there on the radio?
No, I haven't.
Yeah, I was wondering about that. I'm going to check that out myself. I haven't checked that out.
I am aware of some of the, you know, darker aspects of some of
Actually,
the Eastern
that is very
tradition.
Dark. Very
oh
dark.
Yeah, yeah, Tibetan Buddhism.
That
that's a load of crap in this
they
one.
Absolutely,
more stuff in
the light stuff. That's like the worst aspects of Christianity during the Middle Ages, transformed into kind of an Eastern kind of idea and multiplied by 1,000. In fact, the Buddhism that we get exposed to in the West is not the atypical. It's the other side. That's the if you read the history of Tibet, it's terrifying. It's like this. It was like the altered reality of human suffering.
My guru has met with the Dalai Lama. Okay, my guru is like a big deal in the Hindu world, and he told me flat out that guy's not enlightened.
Oh,
he says he's a good front man, and you know he bows and grins and says interesting things, but he is not enlightened.
No, he's whole transhumanism shit now. Have you seen that?
Yeah.
Like saying the whole thing of like, well, the day is becoming where our souls can be transferred into the machine and this will be the evolution of humanity. It's like, fuck you. It's like, I can't stand this. I can't stand this guy. Do you ever know, and your Swami, your boss Swami, is right. Yeah. Because if you listen to any of the quotes attributed to the Dalai Lama, they're like fucking Hallmark greeting cards.
Yeah.
And like, you know,
it's all very shallow stuff.
Oh, very trite. Very fucking trite. And it's like things like, you know, love is good, hate is bad. It's like, you need
fortune cookies.
That was Yoda, yeah.
I believe every human being has the capacity for compassion.
Well, yeah.
Look him! Newsflash!
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
You have my mansion, Dalai Lama.
3 pints of lager and a packet of crisps.
We're going to offend Richard Gere, guys.
Yeah, yeah.
Let him be offended. I'll give him my address. He can come and see me.
Yeah. Of course he's listening, Sonic. What do you think? Of course
he is. Can I just give a little bit of a science update? I mentioned at the top of the show that I had these things around my electronic equipment, and Dan's just texted me. They're called ferrite beads.
Okay.
Yeah, I've heard of those.
Yeah. Well, they're all over my electronics here. So
nice.
Coming out loud and clear.
Got the whole guy in Matrix set up there, huh?
What are they supposed to
do? That's like
Guy Organite.
Distortion decreases electrical distortions or something, right? Is that what you said? Kind of like the Organite.
I've no idea. He gave me them last night, and I was on a space cake, so.
Right on.
I just took them and went.
Steve, Steve, I wanted to say something else too about when you mentioned how when I first joined, like what my intentions were and stuff, and that carried me through for a long time. The good intentions and the positive ideas of thinking about, well, what's good here, what's useful, what can we take from this, not what can we judge or break down or suspect or whatever. There's plenty of bad press. What's the truth? What, you know, and all that. And when I came onto the radio shows, I felt like I had armed myself with enough of the positive aspects. And then when I came face to face with the wave of criticism, knee-jerk prejudice and bigotry around Freemasonry by the truther movement as a whole, I immediately assumed that opposing stance, because that's kind of my way anyways. Like I'm all about the anti-trend. If everybody's going one way, I'm usually going the other way, just because I don't like following the crowd. I like to kind of stay back and sort of watch the crowd and say, are they going off the cliff? I don't know if I want to go that way. You know?
Right.
But I just kind of hang back. And then maybe I might, okay, yeah, that sounds like, maybe we'll check that out. But in that way, though, I felt like the baby was being thrown out with the bathwater with everybody's denouncing and completely dismissing anything within the system. Because I recognize certain aspects of the mind, the terra incognita of the ideas of the mechanics of consciousness that we're being tooled with within the system, that there were things that, and I know that Swami knows what I'm talking about, because that's how we were all of us, me, him, Mark Passio, and others, and even you guys, have been able to build a rapport universally around these themes that are universal themes about consciousness, that are universal ideas about the questions that the guest here tonight, Ray, asked, you know, who are we, where are we come from, and where are we going? And what is at the root of all this? Because we can all speculate and throw around conspiracy theories and stories and horror stories and all these things, and they're true, a lot of them, and it's really important to recognize bad things to try to avoid them in the future. But also, the truths that underlie the principles that are being toyed with. I mean, even if it is like, you know, dark occultic mystics on one side have taken the tools in the toolbox and turned into something horrible over here, that doesn't mean that the tools are all bad in that box.
Right,
there's things in that box that are useful. We can't throw out a hammer just because it's used in a crime. You know, it still can build a house.
Well, I've taken the ancient, I don't know, I don't mean to call it ancient, but perhaps the Freemasonry of the time period of the founding of the country, in that when it was the European Freemason, the York Rite, perhaps. To me, that's Western yoga.
Their intent is
doing the same thing. It's a more mental aspect, but it works when done properly. And when guided properly, and just like any other ability that brings power and influence, it can be corrupted by those who insert themselves in for the purpose of corrupting a good thing. So it's hurtful to me to hear people just have this blanket negative when they hear Freemasonry or when they hear the word guru. My God, that pisses me off. And being enlightened and getting pissed off is normal.
But the final analysis
just means the one who knows and can remove the ignorance, you know? And so many people say the word guru like they're holding a dead rat by the tail. And the same with Freemasonry. And I hate seeing that because it's a misunderstanding. There are those within who have taken advantage of the title or of the system for their own less than pure ends, but they don't represent the whole.
But now having said that, for me, you know, having said that, like the positive side and the productive or whatever, what's really practical and all that stuff, for the sake of discussions like we're having or the sake of people who are talking about what's going on in the world with, like, you know, global power elites taking over of our lives or anything like that, it is more important to focus on how it's being misused to try to avoid that and to try to identify that, to try to say, hey, that's wrong. We can't buy into this. So I can see where it sort of marginalizes my view almost automatically because most people aren't trying to join a lodge. Most people don't even care about being a Freemason, so it doesn't matter to them. What really matters is where's this bad stuff going on and why are they doing it and what can we do about it? You know what I mean? Like that's what matters. And I get that, you know, so it's not like my mission is to at all extol the benefits or virtues of Freemasonry or even to say people go join a lodge. As a matter of fact, I would advise against it most of the time, unless it's just something you feel like you have to do. I mean, I would say that you can find what you need by looking within. I mean, that's what it said over the Oracle of Delphi, you know thyself and know the secrets of the universe. Right. So, you know, you want to know, you don't need to go to a lodge. You just need to go to a lodge within and find out what's going on. And some people, you know, everybody has a different way of doing that. There's a million ways up the mountaintop.
Exactly.
We don't all, and that's the greatest thing about life as far as I'm concerned, is that there is a variety. And that I like the idea that you don't have to join any order, any school, any principal teachings, whatever. You just be who you are, you know? I mean, like, it's like that simple.
Do what
you like. And try not to hurt people. And be who you
and
are.
Don't
you
steal.
Yeah. And don't steal stuff, yeah. It's real basic, you know? But yeah. But I did want to kind of move away from Freemasonry because I don't want it to be the only thing we talk about. There's so many exciting things going on. You know, we got Jan Ervin and Joe Atwill coming back on the show on Friday the 13th, full moon Friday the 13th. And we're talking about their new video. Have you guys checked out the new video?
No, huh?
From GnosticMedia.com. How about you, Steve? Or
yeah,
Sonic?
I've been on it.
Oh, Steve's got some issues. I can tell. What's up, brother?
Oh, it's all right. I've just read an amazing book they've put out called, well, it's not them, it put it out. It's a colleague of theirs by David McGowan.
Oh, that's what I was going to go with it. Yeah, you've read the book.
Fucking amazing.
Isn't that amazing?
By the can.
Oh, man.
Mind-blowing. Oh. Mind-blowing.
And then, of course, they did a whole bunch of interviews. Jan Ervin interviewed him, too.
Yeah. I do not have an issue with Jan Ervin. Or Joe Atwell was actually broken bread with me, and he's an amazing gentleman.
Oh, he's such a great guy.
He's
he really
in
is.
Our house, and we Fry Chick put on a talk for him down here, and he's got some strong issue. You know, he's going to do some good. He came over here to do a symposium with his book, and it was amazing. It sold out. It was fantastic.
Yeah, we're looking forward. I mean, I hope he can make the conversation. It's still not totally clear whether he's going to be there. I just put the link for the new video they did, Psychedelic Intelligence, the CIA and the Counterculture.
Yeah.
And guys, this is amazing stuff. I mean, combine this with the article they wrote, Manufacturing the Deadhead. And then connect that with what you just mentioned. I mean, the weird seeds inside the canyon, the Wrecking Crew, put it with Edward Bernays' propaganda from 1928, and that paper I just mentioned, Changing Images of Man. I mean, this is the making for a thesis in and of itself. This stuff is real intense because I bought into that, man. I mean, I totally did. I was the guy, you know, the drifter, wanderer, vagabondage, you know, hitchhiker on the road, you know.
Well, there's still a large part of me that still is into that.
Yeah, so it's hard to let it go.
Yeah.
Go ahead. Sorry, Steve. Go.
No, there is some still, you know, validity in what went on there. Not because of what the CIA maybe started it, but they didn't know what the fuck was going to happen with it. Do you know what I mean? So
Right. Well, and very often these social engineers, they have, you know, they sit in their little rooms with their three-piece suits and whatever, and they come up with these big ideas, but they don't work out that way because the human spirit has something incorruptible within it.
Yeah, that's true.
And the best will rise to the top, and the rest will fall by the wayside.
Yeah. Have you read the Weird Scenes Inside the Canyon, Fredo?
I've read the original version of it. It was called Inside BLC,
online version.
Yeah, I've read that whole thing, and so has Materex. I think I don't know if she finished it, but she's.
I haven't finished it, but I'm still working on it. It's
have
fascinating.
Have you read Program to Kill by him?
Yeah. Oh, good God, that's just so.
That was awful. That story of Brussels. Brussels is hell on earth. It turns
Brussels
out, huh?
Brussels is fucking hell on earth.
That place is awful.
Have you read it? Have you got through it?
I read the first chapter on Mind Control 101, and then the next one was all about pedophilia, and I had to skim it because it was so awful. I couldn't even read it all.
Oh, it's dreadful.
Gross.
It's
dreadful. And, like, I really am starting to think that, you know, Pete Townsend's a real scumbag too, man.
Totally.
I mean, I just got to tell you, I kind of gave him the benefit of the doubt until I read some of the stuff in here, but
me too.
Wow. Yeah. I mean, and I love The Who, I got to tell you.
So, oh, yeah.
That's the hardest thing about all this is because I feel an emotional attachment.
Right,
That's the point. That's how this all fits together.
That's how
guys.
They twist it in.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Because I went on live with Bob the Bob Tuscan Show. I hosted his show last week, and I did a 3-hour live where I just put it to the audience. I'm like, call in, let's debate this. And I just read a few statistics off the different sites that are up there. The reactions I got, people get freaked out by this stuff. It really causes a lot of collateral reactions. I mean, tell you, it's an insightful.
I have no problem anymore separating the art from the personality.
Bottom line.
I think that's the idea with pop culture and pop celebrity idea is to fuse the person with the art. If you detach both, it makes it a lot easier.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And it doesn't change a thing called the music's beautiful. It doesn't matter who made it. I love the music. I hear you. That's the point is. Mm-hmm. It doesn't matter if it's one guy's name or another girl's name or, you know, there's like a quote from a famous drummer who said, you know, I found out my top 10 favorite drummers were all the same guy.
Yeah.
You know, because like the Wrecking Crew, which just type in the Wrecking Crew, anybody listening, I mean, it's the whole point is there was like top like 15 session musicians who did all the music from the late 50s all the way up to the 70s.
Glenn Campbell played all those Monkeys and Buds.
Leon Russell.
Yep.
We gave Glenn Campbell a lovely tribute on this session.
Glenn Campbell. Love the guy. Yeah, in the online version, it's pretty much 70% of the book is that, and then the rest is just more mind blowing shit than that. You know, the history of the Mansons and all that. It's just like, oh my fucking God.
Well, there's that book, The Family, that Ed Saunders wrote. When I first read that book, that blew me. People don't talk about that book anymore. It came out in like 1970 or something. The Family by Ed Saunders. And the thing that really stood out about that book is, and I didn't realize, was all the accounts of Satanistic friggin'. You know, like people were dying in that Topanga Canyon and Laurel Canyon region in the 60s. It was like the death toll was staggering. The number of, can you think about it? Even to this day, kids are running to California, runaways. Yeah. In my day in the 90s, the road kids, that's what we called them. I was one of them. But I was older. I was in my 20s. There was like 14, 15, 16-year-old kids hopping trains and all going to San Francisco and just getting devoured on those streets. I mean, devoured. I watched it happen a few times. It was horrible. I mean, and then that was in the 90s. We're talking 30 years before where, you know, like the whole Black Dahlia murder, that kind of scenario.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
There was stuff like that going on.
When I lived in New York, I had a boss. I used to do house painting, and he took off his shirt one day, and he had this huge, huge hole in his chest. And I was like, what the fuck happened there? And he goes, oh, I was living in San Francisco in the late 60s, and I got shot in the back by a cop. I said, you kidding me? Yeah, I was lying in bed one night. We were like a bunch of hippies in a room. Cop came in, bang, shot me while I was lying face down. And he survived, but he lost a lung. And he said, that whole summer of love, that whole peace thing, he said it was the biggest load of bullshit. He says, that song, if you go to San Francisco, have flowers in your hair, He said the real lyrics should have been, if you're going to San Francisco, have a 38 in your pocket.
That was John Phillips who wrote that.
It was that dangerous.
Son of Major John Phillips.
Yeah, connection
it was
to...
It was almost like they brought all these nice kids into that area in order to fuck them up.
Let's talk about that for a minute, okay? The baby boomer generation, the largest demographic born in America at that point. They were going to be, you know, these kids are coming to age, and the parents, the ones who had fought in the great, you know, World War II, they had all gotten the GI Bill, and they were all doing well enough to put their kids in school. Now the kids are getting educated using critical thinking and questioning the establishment, right? We got to do something about this, man. What are we going to do? So what do? I mean, they talk about this in the book and also in the interviews. The anti-war movement pre-existed the hippie movement. Mm-hmm. It was a bunch of clean-cut college kids who were all saying, no war. This is bullshit, right? And then the hippie movement gets injected into it, and it totally changes everything, right?
Jack Kerouac, that Beat Generation, which had nothing to do with the war generation.
Exactly.
And the CIA had this idea of fusing both together.
Yeah. And so we get this, like, drugs and free love and question authority and freaky, long hair, dirty, weird looking. And what did it do? All the parents who had laid their lives down for the Great War thought it was unpatriotic. It created an instant gap, an instant divide. You had to either be with us or you're with the freaking hippies. And you ought to just, you know, you ought to just be shipped out of here. You don't like it, leave, you know, blah, blah, blah. And so what did that do? That polarized everything, made you take and make a choice, and it actually served the establishment because it diminished the onslaught that was coming. I mean, what happened? I mean, what happened as a result of all the so-called movement of the 60s? I mean, it's worse now than it was then.
Come on.
Where's all the civil rights? Where's all the stuff we're supposed to get from all this movement stuff? We're all slaves.
Yeah.
It's worse now. Go ahead.
It's not the Jetsons, is it?
No, it's not the Jetsons. There's no flying cars, you know, no tube technology. I'm really upset about that.
Who wants to hear one of the bombshells from the book Weird Signs, Weird Scenes Inside the Canyon? Right, you know the Altamont shoot.
Oh, you're gonna say it. I was thinking it. Go ahead. Yeah, it's a big one. Yeah.
You know the one. You know the one I mean. Then, yeah.
I know exactly what you're gonna say. The filmmaker, right?
The footage of that concert and that shooting of that Meredith, was it?
Yeah. Wait a second, though, Steve. Let's build up to that. You can't just drop the bomb. You got to build up to it a little bit, okay? Give him a little timeline here. We're talking about the famous Gimme Shelter movie with the Rolling Stones that was filmed at Altamont Speedway outside of San Francisco, right after Woodstock, right after or before the Manson murders. So Woodstock happens. 500,000 people, all from the baby boomer generation, show up. It's a movement now. It scared the shit out of the establishment. They're like, oh my God, the hippies are going to overtake us. The, you know, barbarians are at the gate. So then what do? They have Altamont, the free concert where they murder a black man.
No. They don't murder him. They sacrifice him.
Yes, sacrifice.
They sacrifice them.
Don McLean said it right in American Pie.
Absolutely.
Right? It was sacrifice. He sung about it in the song. So what do? They kill the black man. They stabbed him in front of the stage. And they did it. The big bombshell is they did it in the first 15 minutes of the set. They kept going, and they were playing Sympathy
what?
For the Devil.
Sympathy for the Devil.
I had no idea.
Wow.
Because they changed the sequence for the movie. They changed the sequence. You can't see that's what happened.
Yeah.
What's the big bombshell, Steve?
The guy who shot the footage was none other than George Lucas.
That's right, everybody.
Holy shit.
Working for Martin Scorsese, who did the film. That's right.
Oh, my God.
George fucking Lucas. It was his first commission.
Yep.
How about that?
So, you know, then you think of all of the young people that traveled to California during that time period, all of the murders that happened. I mean, who's to say that a whole bunch of them weren't just ritual sacrifices to solidify the hold that the, you know, I don't know, mm-hmm. power structure had there? Because... that could be just as likely. They were innocent people coming there just with big dreams and big hopes. And then, you know, all of a sudden they're just gone.
Yep. Never heard of again.
And then right around the same time, right after that, Manson family slayings.
Oof.
And then right after that, the Wonderland.
Wonderland.
The Wonderland
Models, yeah.
Yeah, that's what I mean. That too.
Yeah, that was right around the corner from Jerry Brown, who was the, you know, just a kid then living in the Laurel Canyon area. Yeah. But what does it mean? So then in 1975, when I was like 5 or 6 years old, my friend's, his house was right up against the woods in my hometown in New England. And his mom used to say to us, now don't go too far in those woods because there's hippies living out there and they eat babies.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. That was in 1975, you know, 6 years after the Manson slayings, right? So.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And well, straight after that, getting into the early 70s, you've got the Jim Jones stuff going down as well, haven't you?
Right.
Absolutely.
And all the people who are connected to that. One of the guys who was involved in the cleanup operation of that was none other than Mark Chapman.
Right. Yeah. He was in that church, International something, World Church or whatever. Yeah.
Oh, I got the Process Church.
Process. Was he a member of the Process
Church? I got a scoop on that.
No, that's right. He was. And the Process Church was around in the 60s in the Laurel Canyon region. They were right in that same thing. That's the Process Church. That's right.
Last week, by sheer accident, I bumped into the actor Nabil Shabazz, who played Mark Chapman in a one-man play in the Edinburgh Festival. And he told me that he studied Mark Chapman in depth. Not only did he agree with the whole thing that Mark Chapman was an MK Ultra, Sahan type killer, but the night before he killed Lennon, he attended a black mass ritual.
Well, before his trip out to New York from, because he went from Hawaii via California to New York, he visited Kenneth Anger and gave him some bullets to bless. And Anger said, what are you going to do with these? He's going, well, I'm going to kill John Lennon. He's going, well, I'm not fucking blessing them. Fuck off.
Kenneth Anger, of course, Church of Satan, who did Lucifer Rising
with Bobby Fuseli.
Yeah, Bouzelet was connected to the Manson family. So, but boom, right there.
This guy who played Mark Chapman in the play, he was telling me that after the play was over, he nearly felt like he had to go to an exorcism because he felt like he was possessed by a demon.
Oof.
Wow.
Yeah. Let's talk about that for a minute, you know. So you move forward from that. I remember in the 90s I heard tale of the band Tool – using Enochian calls that they were doing Enochian rituals when they were making Enema and Undertow, their two most successful albums, I believe, to date. Mm-hmm. And then I found out that Marilyn Manson, who during his Antichrist Superstar tour in the 90s, which I saw at the Warwick Theater in San Francisco, amazing, old, weird, creepy theater with like the balconies and the scroll works and all the, you know, velvet, everything's all weird and, you know, just something you'd see out of a movie. And, He actually integrated Enochian calls from the Enochian system into his performance, into the song lyrics, so that at different times he would have the crowd chanting with him, and they toured America, toured the world with this show. Mm-hmm. So it's just sort of remarkable to me to think about, you know, wow, if you were, you know, a dark occulted magician or whatever, and you were trying to do some really, really serious global enchantments, boy, you could really, that would be effective. You know, what kind of doorways could you open? What kind of things could you make happen? And one of the key things that was brought up a moment ago, Mater X was talking about the runaways and the kids that would just go missing every year in the 60s, right? So it wasn't just the runaways, though. There was like one guy. Do you remember the Dating Game Killer?
Yeah.
Yeah, they talk about. Okay, so here's the thing. The Dating Game Killer, this guy comes on the Dating Game, which, of course, was the brainchild of Chuck Barris, who made right. that movie, Confessions of a Sick Mind, or what was it called? Confessions of a Dangerous Mind, where he's the guy who did the Gong Show, who claimed that he was really an assassin for the CIA as a cover when he was going on the trips that the Dating Game contestants would
be. Right, because there would be no reason for the host of the show to be accompanying folks places.
The killer was called Richard Akela.
And you're talking about Dating Game Killer?
Yeah, Richard Akela.
He was one of the contestants who won the show, and the girl refused to go with him because she was creeped out by him. Now, the thing about him was his first major crime was he had kidnapped and bludgeoned and raped an 8-year-old girl who ended up, she didn't die. She lived. And she actually was, years later when they finally caught him and he was on trial to be executed, she finally testified as a woman, like a 21-year-old woman, and actually for the sentencing, so he got death because she testified what he did to her. But she was the daughter of a record producer. And there were several other girls who got killed who were daughters of very, like Sharon Tate was the daughter of Major or Captain Tate, who was in Air Force Intelligence.
That's true.
So these people who's their own siblings, it kind of goes into that line, like maybe they sacrifice their own children to like become successful.
Yeah,
you know?
it's that Abrahamic Isaac thing.
Exactly. Yeah. There you go.
I mean, I know it's early days, and I'm kind of conservative about this stuff, but that shooting in California 2 weeks ago, the father of the kid, the young guy who was killed, is now a celebrity on the anti-gun circuit. And it's almost like the Abrahamic thing again. Like, it always seems to be when there's always a parent at these mass shootings who ends up becoming a celebrity who seems to show no remorse and is handsomely rewarded by the control grid.
Well, one of the most disturbing things in Program to Kill, David McGowan's other book, really hard, finding it difficult to get through, but one of the worst statistics from his thing is the amount of people whose children have been put up for snuff films and thing is on the rise by 400% since records began.
Yeah.
Wow.
Which is just, that beggars belief.
The new Craigslist killer, that girl that supposedly was part of some satanic ring, killed like 20, she lost count at 22 people or whatever. Mm. Her father is a military man who is calling for her execution.
He's calling for her execution.
Yeah, he's calling for her execution, her own father, on publicly, you know, out loud. And she said she was made to do this as a child. They held the gun in her hand and got her to do it, and then she started doing it on her own after that.
Yeah.
You know, so, but the point is, it's like you're saying, it's like the parents are just throwing their kids to the wolves. You know what I mean?
Right,
just
right.
Like,
for a little bit of benefit.
We can get by if you make
the
a...
The kid from Hunger Games, he looks really like Harold Shipman.
Oh, God.
Yeah, he
gets my
David Harold Shipman, the doctor in England who killed all the women.
About 300 people, all his patients.
At least. They'll never know because he killed himself now, so that's gone to the grave, isn't it? As has who's it? Fred West.
He drew
up the blueprints for the torture chambers that they're uncovering now in Belgium.
Oh yeah, that was unbelievable.
Yeah.
The guy gets 13 years.
I was struck by the thing that he lived on Cromwell Street.
Oh, he gets 13 years. He gets let out after 3, and then he sets up these death chambers all over town, right? And he starts churning. And people, obviously, all these officials are all involved. All of them are involved.
Yeah.
It's just unbelievable.
It's his name, Phillips Dutroux.
I was watching a documentary this week about Broadmoor Prison, and one of their most notorious psychopaths was a guy who went into the prison after trying... His father gave him a chemistry set as a kid, and he was then developing poisons and poisoning people with the chemistry set. Like kids, you know, toy chemistry set.
Mm.
He went to Broadmoor. The psychiatrist declared him functional again. They got him a job in a photographic lab where there are chemicals everywhere, and he started poisoning the staff in the lab.
Wow.
There's no
I remember
way
that story, yeah.
There's no way that was accidental.
Right.
Of all the jobs they get him one in a photo lab with all the most dangerous
chemicals are. Yeah, that pattern is going on, too.
There's also that report that came out from the Department of Health, where it was talking about Dr. Saville.
Dr. Saville, that one's...
Dr. Saville?
Yeah. They're referring to Jimmy Saville as Dr. Saville.
Oh, yeah, Saville. Okay.
Oh, really?
Ooh. Yeah.
Ooh, that's not good.
Oh, I got an interview on a mainstream radio show about my theories on that. It's definitely simmering now.
Oh, really?
So think about it, though, the pattern, right? So we talked about Chuck Barris, who came out with his book about being a dangerous mind and all that. And then in the book, the LC there, they talk about Houdini, the same exact pattern in, like, the turn of the century, okay? Harry Houdini, he comes from nowhere. He's an immigrant with nothing. He's so unsuccessful as a magician, he has to sell himself to the freak show, to pretend to be a freak, to make money, to pay, you know, to feed himself and his wife. And then all of a sudden he has a meeting with this guy named Wilkes in Chicago, who's like the head of the police department there. And he turns around and he's like, goes from city to city, becomes the most famous performer. Well, it turns out that Wilkes was connected to the Secret Service at the time.
Yeah.
Which is kind of remarkable because his name is Wilkes, but it looks like Wilkes, as in John Wilkes Booth, who supposedly was also connected to the Secret Service.
Yeah.
And also was a performer touring.
He was a sleight of hand guy, yeah.
And a sleight of hand guy. And so he was, it's spycraft. So Houdini, right? What is this book called? The Secret World of Harry Houdini just came out. The Secret History of Harry Houdini or whatever. And what it is that Harry Houdini, he becomes the most popular, most famous performer in America, the highest paid performer at the turn of the century. And then what does he do? Commits career suicide and goes on a European tour. Because that would have been suicide at the time. Why wouldn't you just stay in America and reap in the profits touring America where all the money? But he goes to Europe where he's totally unknown. And goes from one obscure city in one country after another where he meets with the high-ranking law officials in those cities and then becomes an instant overnight phenomenon. So what is the claim? Well, if you know anything about the Houdini Act, what would usually happen is he'd have some kind of intricate escape where they would put a big drape down around it and everybody would have to wait around for like 45 minutes or an hour for him to do his escape, and then they'd go, ta-da, and they'd open the curtain and there he would be. Well, guess what? You could get out of that in the first 5 minutes and then go do some secret spy work for 50 minutes and then come back and, you know, jump out like you
Right.
Yeah, ta-da! You know, you've already stolen the documents, shot the official, you know, swam the Thames, whatever you had to do. Now you're back like James Bond, you know what I mean? Now you're back.
Right.
So that's what they're telling us was going on with Houdini as well.
Absolutely.
Crazy. You know, everything we know is wrong.
And then 20 years after that, Frank Zappa moves into his house.
Yeah, the same house. Well, no, he moved into Tom Mix's house, another cowboy.
Another log cabin. Did Houdini not stay in a log cabin after his other house burnt down?
90 seconds.
But yeah, so what about all today, right? You have Beyonce and all these other performers who go to like Dubai and they go to like the Emirate of Arabs. They go to these places and you're like, huh, you just see a little news blip about it. You're like, what's that all about? What if they are monarch level couriers, right? Mind control couriers. They're doing some spycraft, but they're there under the auspices of a performance for the royal family of Saudi Arabia or something, you know?
Sasha Frio. There she is. Well, guys, that's been
60 seconds.
Where the hell did that 2 hours go?
Stay tuned for that full moon Friday the 13th this month on the Middle Chamber over at Syncbook Radio. Well, Jan Irvin and Joseph Atwell.
Jan Irvin,
you guys doing a show tonight?
No, we're gonna run this show right here.
Oh, right. This is pretty good.
Hi, Alan. Well, it's been a lot of fun, guys. We're going to end with a little blues tune, if you don't mind. This is by a guy called Grinder Switch. I don't know if you know them or not, but this will be familiar to Nick. So good night. I'll see you next week when we've got Michael Benicio.
Yeah, excellent.
Good night, everybody.
Thanks for calling in, Ray.
Ten seconds.